This is one of those verses where we really can't start here. We have to go back because the context starts back in chapter 1 and verse 2. When trials come into our lives, no matter what kind, bereavements, financial setbacks, troubles and difficulties of every kind, what are we supposed to do? Count it all joy. All right. We have to find a way to be joyful in our tribulations. And he says the reason why you should feel joyful in your tribulation is because what does it produce?
Patience.
It produces patience or endurance, steadfastness. And steadfastness leads to perfection so that you can be perfect and entire, lacking in nothing. So there's something about these trials and our response to them that is very important to our relationship with God. And if we do not know how to count it all joy, what does he say to do? Verse 5. If any of you lack wisdom,
ask
of God. He'll give it to you liberally. He will not upbraid you, but ask in faith. Then he moves to the trials of wealth and poverty. Are there any trials to wealth? Yeah, there are plenty of trials to wealth. How about poverty? Yeah, and I don't know which is worse. Remember the man in Proverbs who said, give me neither poverty nor riches, because each one has difficulties. What did Jesus say about the rich man? How easy is it for a camel to go through the eye of a needle?
Easier than a rich man to get into
heaven. Exactly. It's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than the rich man to get into heaven. So there are trials. Trials of pride and arrogance, and as Jesus said in the parable of the sower, choking the word and becoming unfruitful. But how about poverty? Any trials to poverty? Yeah. Boy, it's tough to be poor. It's very difficult. And so he spends a little bit of time on that. Then he moves to temptations to sin, and he says, where's the source of that? Does any of that come from God? No, where's it all come from? Comes from our heart. Each man is tempted when he is drawn away by his what?
His own lust
and
enticed,
which means baited. Means that something's dangling in front of him, but why is it dangling there? Because of his lust. You see, an enticement can't be an enticement unless what? Unless we are interested in it. And that's why when we look at the lust of the flesh, can we be enticed by all of them? Anybody here enticed to murder, enticed to commit adultery, enticed to steal? Well, some of them yes, some of them no. But if we can be enticed by it, then we need to do what Joseph did. What did Joseph do when that woman tried to seduce him?
He fled.
He ran away. He fled. He got out of the situation. Because there's a limited amount of time where that can happen. And I don't know that he was afraid he was going to commit adultery, but what if somebody caught him in that situation? So she's got him by the garment. What's the best thing to do? Because what does she do even though he is out of there? But she's got the garment.
She lies about
him and gets him into trouble. So I think he was taking thought for things honorable in the sight of all men. I think that he didn't want to be in that situation. Nobody would want to be in a situation like that. All right, so that's where the trials come from. The trials that come from bereavement and sorrow and difficulties, then the trials that come from temptations, but they come from a different source. Now, what he wants to do here starting in verse 17 is he wants to let us know that what only comes from God? Only good things come from God. So where's all the bad coming from then? Is it coming from God? No, not directly. It's coming as a consequence. We remember that the world God gave us in Genesis chapter 1 and verse, what is it, 21 or 30, I'm sorry, 28 or 31, somewhere in there. God saw everything he made. It was very good. And I went ahead and put that in the middle of page 1. I'm not going to take the time this week because we are still reviewing. But there's a very big difference between the way Genesis opens and the way Ecclesiastes opens. Because in Ecclesiastes, it went from all is very good to what?
All is vanity.
All is futile. All is empty. Well, what happened? What intervened between the creation God gave us and the one we have now?
Sin.
the curse of sin. So Ecclesiastes deals with the sin-cursed world under the sun. Genesis 1 deals with the God-blessed world, which was perfect in every sense. Perfect and everything that it needed to be. I don't think heaven will be any more perfect than what God originally gave us in the physical creation. Because what comes directly from the hands of God, according to this verse? Every good gift, every perfect gift, coming down from above. Did the heavens and the earth come down from above? Yeah, they did. Well, what about the rest of it? Where's the rest of it coming from if it's not coming from above? Where do most of our trials come from? Well, they come from beneath, right? The curse is here. Is the curse in heaven? Does God send the curse down from heaven every time he wants to cause a problem to somebody? No. No. The curse came because God had to curse the world as a result of what we did. Out of our own best interest. Because if God had made the world perfect and continued to be perfect, who'd be motivated to become a Christian if you never had any problems? If nobody died, if everything was just wonderful here, then that's what would happen. So James now is going to talk to us about what comes from God. And so he starts out, and again, we spent some time on this one last week, so I don't want to spend too much time on it this week, but the word good just means absolute excelling in every way. It's just wonderful, it's blessed, it's good, it is useful. So let's go ahead and turn to page 2. There's two Greek words for gift. You can't see it in English, but you can see it in the Greek. And the first word for gift also means giving. So it is essentially an account of giving and receiving. So if you have a ledger book and you got one side is what went out, what's the other side? What came in? So what comes in is the idea here. So God is every act of giving. I think there's a distinction between the two in that one is the gift itself, the second one, and one is the act of giving. Can somebody give you a good gift with a very ulterior motive? Yeah. So what about the acts of giving? Do they have to be good too? Well, that's what we hear about God. So we know that from God, his giving and his gifts are both good. It's interesting because both of the words can have the idea of giving or gift. So I think they're both in here. I think that what it's saying is that God's motives for everything he gave us and the use we find for everything he gave us are both gifts that are first good and second perfect. And I don't know if you remember the definition of perfect. I put it in here, just a small portion of it, right under that first paragraph, under every perfect gift, where it says, brought to its end, finished, wanting nothing necessary to completeness. So when the creation came from God, he told Adam and Eve, what have I given you over everything?
Dominion.
What does dominion mean? Who's in control? We in control today? No, we're not in control, because at any moment something can drop down that we weren't expecting and completely take away what it was that we thought we could do. And so, again, financial setbacks, bereavements, health problems, accidents, people wanting to hurt us, murders, all of these things come in, and that's what Ecclesiastes deals with, is that because of what happened at the curse, we don't have any control anymore. We don't have any dominion. But what came from God, can you not have dominion if it's perfect and it doesn't lack anything to being complete? No, that's what full dominion is. So there's nothing missing. So what James wants us to understand is that everything in our life that is good, where did it come from? Came from God. Everything that's perfect, everything that's complete, came from God. Where's the rest of it coming from? Not from God, not directly. You see, God created the heavens and the earth perfect. Why isn't it perfect today? Because we sinned. Did God warn him that he would die if he ate of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? So he went in there with his eyes open, and so did Eve. She was deceived, but only because she didn't trust God. If she had trusted God, would she have been deceived? No, because what did God say will happen if you eat of that tree? You'll die. If she believed God when Satan said you won't die, could she have been deceived? And that's the key. And, of course, when she chose to do that, that's what started this whole thing. That's what started. Everything that goes back to bad goes back to Adam and Eve. Everything that's good goes back to God. And if we could just see it like that, when these trials come, you know, when people start saying, why is God doing this to me? Is there a problem with that statement? Yeah. Does he do that? No, he doesn't do that. He's not doing that to you. Even Job, was God doing that to him? No, that was Satan. Job had a completely he'd left one person out of the equation, the devil. And with him out of the equation, what does that make God look like?
Bad guy.
See, he looks like the bad guy, but he's not. He's the good guy all the way through. And of course, Job learned that in the end, and he repented. But everything coming down from above is good and perfect. Everything is good and perfect. And if we can just keep that in our minds, then when these trials come and we realize that this is a result of what Adam and Eve did, and as Paul said, and of course this is spiritual death, but I don't think the physical death is any different, but it says that death passed to all men in Romans 5:12 because all sinned. So who among us is going to say, I don't deserve what I'm getting? I didn't do what Adam and Eve did. Can we say that? No, we can't say that. Because we've all sinned. And once you sin, and of course there's some innocent children that do go through some things, but that's a domain that we have to leave to God. As God said, or as Paul said in Romans 9, who are you to say to God, why'd you make me like that? We should be glad we're here. And we should recognize that God only wants what's good for us. And when these bad things come into our lives, they can turn out to be good if we let them. Paul talks about that in 2 Corinthians, where he says that Jesus revealed to me that my power is made strong in weakness. Therefore, I take pleasures in persecutions and tribulations and trials, because when I am weak, then I am strong. And that's the secret. Remember in Philippians chapter 4? I have learned the secret. I know how to be content in what? In whatever state I'm in. Now that's something worth getting. Did I see your hand up, Charles?
Yes, also along the same lines there. You know, the Bible teaches us too that it rains on the just as well as the unjust. You know, so when that rain comes down, you know, you got a person that keep things together in their yard or whatever. You know, somebody that don't, whenever it rains, both parties is getting water back.
Right. That's right. Okay. At the bottom of page 2, we have coming down from the Father of Lights. Now, there's nowhere else in the Scriptures that talks about the Father of Lights, so we're kind of struggling a little bit. Let's turn to page 3, and we have the verse. That what is God in that first verse, 1 John 1:5? God is light. So if God's light, then what does that mean about all other things that are light? See, he's responsible for it. He's the one who created it. He's the one who's involved in light. What about the devil? What's he involved with?
Darkness.
And when the curse comes, when the final destruction comes, what are those people going to be in forever and ever? The outer darkness. And so everything that's associated with God is light. Everything that's associated with evil, everything that's associated with Satan is darkness. And throughout the Scriptures, in him is light, there is no darkness at all. If we walk in the light as he is in the light, then the blood of his Son is cleansing us from all sin. So, and then, of course, what does it say in Revelation 21:23 there? What don't you need anymore? Now, I realize this is all symbolic and that it's going to be very different than what we can visualize here. But it says the city has no need of what? Doesn't need any doesn't need the sun? Doesn't need the moon to shine on it? Why? Because God's own glory will shine. So he's the Father of lights because he is the source of lights. And of course, he's also the father of lights, because we read in the book of Genesis, what did he do on that first day?
Let there be light.
Let there be light. Then he took that light and he put it into, on the fourth day, he put it into what?
Sun,
the moon, stars. So he made it first. And that's a concept we can't really grapple with. I don't understand how you can make light, physical light, without a beacon or something to put it in. But he does, and he did. Brian?
Yeah, and it's, you know, like you think about Moses, remember when his face shined, and of course when Jesus was transfigured, he was, you know, so light is not just a metaphor, right? Or it's not, you know, it's literal light.
Yeah,
you know,
no, that's why I say this father of lights is a very interesting concept, because it takes in two things. He's the father of light because he's the source of all light, and he's the father of light because who created it? He created the heavens and the earth, and he created all these heavenly bodies that now contain that light. But then there's a problem with the analogy. This is a parable in a sense. When you look up at the sun, the moon, and the stars, do you see beauty? And do we see the goodness of God? And so these lights reflect God's goodness. But there's one problem with the light, and that is that it can vary. In the morning, the afternoon, the evening, in the sun, in the shade, during the as the spring goes into summer, goes into fall, sun is moving back and forth. He actually uses that word. You know, it's not often you find a Greek word that's fascinating, but I thought this one was. So I want you to look at it with me. It's toward the middle bottom of page 3, where it has the word trope or trope, depending on how I would pronounce it, trope. And it means, number one, tropai helioi. Now, helios is what?
Sun.
The sun. So, the changing of the sun, the solstices. So, what happens at the solstice? The sun turns around, right? Sun's going, and then all of a sudden it hits the solstice. What does it do? Turns around, comes back. So that's the word here, and that's how the word is used. So midsummer and midwinter, when the sun appears to turn his course and cross the ecliptic, when tropai is used alone, it most really refers to the winter solstice, a turn or a change. So when a Greek-speaking person read that term, he would think of the solstice. He would think of the sun, you know, and of course, we've talked for years about that. Why did they put Christmas on the 25th of December? Because what happens on the 22nd?
The return of the
sun. Yeah, the sun starts to turn, and there was a big pagan festival, and what did the Pope want to do?
Recruit people.
He wanted to replace it. So he replaced it with Christmas and put it on December 25th. And so we've already become a little bit aware of that. And so, but this term has the idea of the turning of the sun. And of course we notice it. Is the sun a little less strong on the first day of winter as it is on the first day of summer? A little bit brighter, a little bit stronger, a little bit warmer, a little bit, maybe a lot warmer. All right, so God does not have any variation or shifting shadow. He does not. Everything that comes down from him is a stream of pure goodness and perfection and light. And when we start blaming God for anything in our life, what have we done? We've set ourselves up for some. I mean, that's a lie. And if you start with a premise that's a lie, where are you going to end up? See, that's what Job's three friends did to him. He was doing fine till those three friends showed up. He had a perfect understanding. He said to his wife, we cannot do this. We've accepted all this good from God. If this evil comes, we're going to keep serving him. But when the three friends came, they got him to thinking that what was God?
Unjust.
God wasn't being fair to me. He's not being fair. I don't deserve this. And so, where did he end up? So he just got deeper and deeper in. Well, the problem was he didn't understand at that time. And of course, we have him as an example, so we're way ahead already. But we need to understand something, that if there's anything in your life that you're not happy about, look for some other reason or cause. It didn't come from God. It didn't come directly from God. It's a cause and effect thing. Sin brought a lot of things in. Now, some people say, well, yeah, but God's the one who did that. Well, we don't know what God was dealing with there. We don't know. What should God have done, according to 2 Peter and Jude? What did he do to angels when they found themselves in that situation? Cast immediately down into chains of darkness to await the day. So we don't really know what God had to go through. We understand Jesus' death on the cross. That was all a part of him being able to do that. But this physical creation is also a part of him being able to do that. And so we really don't know what forces and concepts and things that God is dealing with. So who are we to say to God, why did you make us like this? Why did you do it like this? Or as Paul says in Romans chapter 8, the whole creation is groaning and travailing together, and not only the whole creation, but we ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit, and we're groaning, waiting for what? The redemption of the body. Okay, hadn't been redeemed yet. So what we're dealing with today is a result of the fact that the body has not yet been redeemed. And with God, all the principles God's dealing with, it can't be. It's all tied together. When Satan gets cast into hell, and all the wicked get cast into hell, is this world going to continue on? No, that's when the change is going to come. So it's all tied together. And you can't, you know, it's kind of like somebody comes up to a machine and says, I don't see any purpose for this. So he starts reaching for it. What do you say? Better not touch that. Because there's nothing in there that isn't where exactly it should be. And if you pull that out, the whole thing may crumble into dust or blow up. So that's what we're focusing on here. So when trials come, when temptations come, who do we not blame them on? God doesn't tempt anyone with evil, and none of the trials came into your life because God directly put it there. It's there because of consequences. Now, that doesn't mean God can't use it. That doesn't mean that if I need a good spanking, can God use these troubles and trials that are here? That he didn't cause, but he can use them. But once again, how's he going to use them? How's Satan going to use them? How's he going to use them? Different? Different as night and day. All right, and then he gives us one example. He says, of his own will. This is the bottom of page 3. Of his own will he brought us forth. Now, that's true in two senses. Did we ask to be created? No, we couldn't. God came up with this plan, and God created Adam and Eve, and God created the heavens and the earth, and everything that we enjoy today is because God decided at some point to create it. And when we fell, when man fell, what did God decide? He'd already decided, back in eternity. What had he decided? I'm going to redeem it. So he brought us forth. Well, you know, basically Jesus deals with it. What do you have to do with Nicodemus? What did he say you have to do? Be born again. So to be born again, what has to happen first? So he brought us forth the first time because we were born. The birth is an amazing thing. And so also is the new birth. And Paul dealt with the same argument. I'm not going to read it. You can see it at the bottom of page 3. Verse 8 just says, God demonstrates his own love and that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. And of course, there was nothing. We were sinners. We were enemies. We were unlovable. There wasn't anything about us that God could love. As a matter of fact, what does Paul start Romans with? The wrath of God is revealed. And so, and what about the Jews? I mean, they had the law. There was no wrath on them, right? No, they word of God's blasphemy, or the name of God is blasphemed because of you. So the Jews. I've always liked that passage in Isaiah that says, as those who sit in the graveyards eating swine's broth and saying, don't come near me because I'm holier than you. And what does God say? That is smoke in my nostrils. It just makes me so mad to see you wicked, ungodly people talking about how you're more holy than the Gentiles when you're sitting in the graves. What did God say about graves? Unclean. Unclean. Swine's broth?
Unclean.
And here they are swigging the swine's broth, sitting on a grave, saying, "Ah, we're holier. You guys don't come near us." And what does God say? Makes me sick. Makes me so. It's like smoke in my nostrils. It just that's where we were. But of His own will, even though that was true, and you look at the numbers are incredible. And Jesus knew that going in. What did He say in Matthew 7? How many are going to say to me on that day, and I'm going to have to say to them, "I never knew you"? Many. But what about the rest of the world who never even said that? Where are they going to go? Same place. So who's He get? Just a tiny remnant. But Paul says in Ephesians chapter 1 that God considers that to be the riches of the glory of His inheritance in the saints. God will inherit the saints, and as far as He's concerned, one saint is like a gold or diamond, a beautiful thing that is costly above everything else. And so you think about gold mining. When you're gold mining and you're just digging up, what are you doing with most of the dirt? Just throwing it away. At the end of the day, maybe you got this much. What do you think about that? That was a good day. We got a lot of money here. This was a good day. Well, yeah, but what about all that stuff over there? Well, it's just what we had to go through to get here. And that's how God sees it, too. So of His own will, He brought us forth by the word of truth. And this, of course, is very close to what Peter said. Peter said that He brought us forth by the living and abiding incorruptible word of God. So the word of truth, the word of God, that's the power that He uses. So there's another good and perfect gift that came down. Jesus is one of those good and perfect gifts that came down from above. And so is the word of God, and so is the church, and so are multitudes of things. All right. So that we might be, as it were, the first fruits among His creatures. First fruits. You know, I spent some time this afternoon looking at different commentaries, quite a few actually, and most of them are saying that what this means is that these early Jews were the first fruits of all the Christians who would follow. But the problem with that is, what about the spirits of the just men made perfect? Are they not first fruits also? Were they not part of what God is going to get when this life is over? So, and if we look at it like that, does this apply to us then? Are we the first fruits? No, this is just talking to the Jews. So I don't think that's the answer. I think there's a different answer. Let's look at the firstborn. Because normally when you think firstborn, what do you think?
First child.
Duh, firstborn means firstborn. Well, what do the Jehovah's Witnesses do with that in Colossians, where it says, "He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation." See, He was the first created being. Is that what that means? Doesn't mean that at all. And He says it. He says, the reason He's the firstborn over all creation is because by Him all things were created. So firstborn can mean first in time. It can also mean preeminent. You know, it can also mean the power. And if you look at that next verse in Romans 8:29, I'm in the middle of page 4 right now. "For whom He foreknew, He also predestined to be conformed to the image of His Son, that He might be the firstborn among many brethren. And then to the general assembly and church of the firstborn, who are registered in heaven." So who are the firstborn? Who's the church of the firstborn? Just those people in the first century? Yeah, you better be in that church of the firstborn. This is the church of Christ. This is the universal church. So the General Assembly and Church of the Firstborn are those people who are considered preeminent. It doesn't mean firstborn in the sense of time. It means firstborn in the sense... Who gets the inheritance when the father dies? Who gets the first choice inheritance? The firstborn. The firstborn gets the main. And God made it clear, remember in the law it said, if you've got a son of a woman you don't like and a son of a woman you do like, but the son of the woman you don't like was born first, what can't you do? You can't make him, you can't take his firstborn status away. So it had to do with preeminence. And so first fruits may have the same concept. And I thought, I think it was Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. I think that's a commentary I found where he made this point, and I put that in there. Another possibility is that all Christians are the first fruit of the entire creation. That we have been redeemed, and our redemption is the promise of a future redemption. Because our souls are redeemed, right? What about our bodies? They're not redeemed yet. What about the whole creation? What are they groaning and travailing for? For the same thing, for a redemption, for a new change. So I think the idea here has more to do with the fact that we are the preeminent, and possibly Christians are the promise. Because what is a first fruit? What is that promise? Because you've got to give all your first fruits to God. But what is a first fruit promise?
There's going to be more.
There's going to be more. So if we're the first fruits, what is the promise? There's going to be more. So we are the first fruits among his creatures, and when the new creation comes, we're going to see things we can't even imagine now. We just can't even imagine. All right, so that's that section. Any question or comments or thoughts? All right, then, let's. Now we've pretty much left that behind, and so let's turn to page 5. And I just got a quick review there, but I'm not going to do it because I don't need to. We've just been through it all. So the final conclusions, though, you see right above verse 19 there, it says, the final conclusions, with all the above in mind, verses 19 and 20, be careful how you hear. Be swift. Be careful how you speak. Be slow. Be careful how you become angry. Be slow. Then 21 through 25, show yourselves, prove yourselves to be doers of the word and not just hearers. And then verses 26 and 27, pure religion is watch your tongue, help others in their afflictions, and keep yourself pure. So that's going to be the rest of the chapter, and so we don't have a lot of time left, but I think we can at least maybe cover part of verse 19. You know, I'm going to leave it to you to study it if you want to or not. There's a textual issue here that as to whether or not it starts out. You see the two textual issues in those two verses. So then versus you know. Now, the problem was that there was a difference of the first letter. One's an iota, one's an omega, and that changed the word. But if you look at the concept, it doesn't really matter. So then means what? When I'm finishing up and I'm making a conclusion, what does that mean you're supposed to do with everything I just said? So then, or therefore. Well, you got to have it in your mind, right? So this is my conclusion. Or you know it. Now, what's the difference between you know it and therefore? Negligible. Doesn't make much difference at all. So this is one of those textual problems that doesn't amount to anything. It doesn't make any difference. So I'm not going to spend any time on it. So let's talk about the word swift to hear and slow to wrath. Now, we have two words that we use in our language. So let's just start with that. What does tachycardia mean?
Fast heartbeat.
Okay, your heart's going too fast. What does bradycardia mean? Going too slow. All right, so tachy, fast. Brady, slow. Guess what the Greek words here are? Well, look at the first one there at the bottom of page 5. Tachys, which is where we get tachycardia from. Of motion, quick, swift, fleet. Opposed to bradus or bradia. Of thought and purpose, quick, rapid, hasty. Speed, haste, so of actions, events, quick, rapid, sudden. So the quickness of hearing should be what? Man, if something comes up, I'm just going to stop. I need to hear that. Faith comes by hearing. So how should you hear? Be swift to hear. If you're sitting down and suddenly you hear something that you've never thought of before, be swift to hear. Listen to it. Hear it out. Think about it. Be quick to hear. So, God wants a quick and attentive mind. Well, that doesn't exactly mean what we might think it would mean, because if you look at all the verses on the back of page 6, where it says, we are all here present before God to hear all that you have been commanded by the Lord. Is that swift to hear? Mm-hmm. Absolutely. How about this other one? These were more noble than those in Thessalonica. They received the word with great eagerness, examining the scriptures daily to see whether these things were so. Is that quick to hear? So see, it doesn't just mean I say something, oh, I need to hear that, but then I quickly forget it. Is that swift to hear? No. Swift to hear is what God says it is. And so you look at those verses in Nehemiah and Ezra, and in Nehemiah, they preached the word and they gave the sense and the people were attentive to it. And then in Ezekiel 33, they're swift to hear. Your people are talking about how wonderful it is to hear you. But what don't they do? They don't do it. And so it says in verse 31, they come to you as people do. They sit before you as my people. They hear your words, but they do not do them. For with their mouth they show much love, but their hearts pursue their own gain. So is that swift to hear? No, swift to hear means making applications. It means growing. It means changing. You remember what? Well, look at Luke 8:18. Therefore, take heed how you hear. For whoever has, more will be given. But to him who does not have, even what he has will be taken away. So we need to be swift to hear. We need to look at these things. You remember Samuel. Has the Lord his great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices? Is it obeying the voice of the Lord? So swift to hear means hearing to obey, hearing to heed, hearing to do. Then I like this passage in Zechariah because it's the opposite of what's swift to hear. They refused to heed, shrugged their shoulders, stopped their ears so that they could not hear. Yes, they made their hearts like flint, refusing to hear the law and the words which the Lord of hosts had sent by his Spirit through the former prophets. So defense mechanisms. I don't want to believe the scriptures, so I've got my defense. And no matter what you say, how do we put it? Don't confuse me with the facts. My mind's already made up. And I've talked to many a person about, they don't believe in the existence of God. So you try to start with that. But you're starting with a losing battle because what have they already decided? And it wouldn't matter what you put in front of them. If you put God himself in front of them, what would they say? I don't believe. I'm not going to do it. So swift to hear has more than just, the preacher's talking. I better be quiet and listen. I mean, that's a part of it, but there's a lot more to it than that. All right, then slow to speak. Now, as I mentioned, and it looks like I'm going to run out of material before I run out of time, but don't worry, I got plenty in my head, so we can handle it. All right, so here on, you see that word bradia, slow, slowest in running, of the mind slowness, tardy, late. Now, if you just read that, what would you say about this? Is this a good word or a bad word? It's a bad word. Wait a minute, do we have a second bell already? Oops. All right, I didn't run out of material. We'll start with slow to speak next week. I'm sorry, I posed on you. Thank you.